The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Thomas Chamorro Primosich. Thomas is international authority on talent management, leadership development, and people analytics. He is the chief talent scientist at Manpower Group, co-founder of Meta Profiling and Deeper Signals, and professor of business psychology at both University College London and Columbia University. He has previously held academic positions at New York University and the London School of Economics. He has lectured at Harvard Business School, Stanford Business School, London Business School, Johns Hopkins, and IMD, in addition to serving as CEO at Hogan Assessment Systems. He has published 10 books and over 150 scientific papers. His latest book is called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? Thomas, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Your book has one of my favorite combinations, an incredibly provocative title, and nuanced content and ideas that really force the reader to confront assumptions that they've likely been carrying around their whole lives. And you offer the central question of your book right away. You write, quote, "What if these two observations, that most leaders are bad and that most leaders are male, are causally linked?" And the answer to that question is?
Yes, is the answer.
Yes is the answer. So
it's, you know, sometimes we hear people, and with a healthy degree of skepticism, make the point that correlation does not always mean causation or causality, but at the same time, correlations always have causes, and in this case, there is a causal link between the overrepresentation of men in leadership positions and also the fact that most of these leaders are just not very good.
Right. And what's interesting about this is that you also note in the book that there's more psychological similarities between men and women than there are actually differences.
Correct. Not just in our own research, but also in scientific research done by my colleagues, including large-scale reviews that summarize the results of hundreds of independent studies. We can see that in about 75% of personality traits, values, and psychological dimensions, men and women are pretty much the same. However, in the remaining 25%, there are differences that explain both why we pick more men than women for leadership roles, and also why the majority of leaders are not very good. Specifically, it's our interest or attraction to three traits that are overrepresented in men, namely overconfidence, charisma, and narcissism. We are seduced by leaders who have these three traits, and at the same time we know that being overconfident, being charismatic, and being narcissistic can impair your performance as a leader once you are in a leadership role.
Yeah, and so this idea is that we think these are attractive leadership qualities like confidence, but there really is no link between confidence and, say, competence.
Correct. Study after study, we see that there's only about 10% overlap between confidence, which basically refers to how good people think they are at something, and competence, which is how good they actually are at something. Increasingly, all the skills, talents, and competencies that are valued in society are actually hard to observe directly. Mm-hmm. For example, to observe whether somebody is creative, whether somebody is an expert in a field, or whether somebody is curious or has strategic thinking. cannot be observed in a short-term interaction like a job interview. That's why we stick to what we can see, and that is confidence. And, of course, men are not just more confident than women. They also get rewarded more and celebrated for displaying confidence overtly and explicitly in short-term interactions, to the point that this even harms men who don't seem typical or masculine confident. And then we assume when men are maybe aware of their limitations and their flaws, and they don't come across as very abrasive or bold, we also dismiss them for leadership jobs, even though it's actually quite healthy and productive to be aware of one's limitations.
Right. Another thing I thought was interesting in talking about men in these leadership roles is that you also note that they focus less on developing others and more on advancing their own career agenda, and that ain't good for being a leader.
Yes, and this is just a natural consequence of the way the system works. Science indicates very clearly that the best measure of how a leader is performing is to ask that leader's subordinates or direct reports, so what we call upward feedback. Feedback from your employees tells me if you're doing well or not, if I should trust you, if you're competent, because your employees can observe you as a leader on an everyday basis. And yet, all leaders get promoted based on what their own leaders think of them. So it's natural that people spend more time managing up than down, even though that is worse for their teams. And if on top of that we are already hiring people who are quite narcissistic and self-centered, that's going to be exacerbated. So the result is that too many leaders are their own biggest fans, and they actually get quite far in life for blowing their own trumpet or taking credit for other people's achievements and spending a lot of time leaning in and self-promoting, even though those are not essential behaviors that we should associate with leadership talent.
Yeah, and as bad as this is, isn't it true that like the more deluded you are, the more incompetent you are, it's likely that you are even more confident about your own abilities?
Correct. So, this is an old effect in psychology that is called the Dunning-Kruger effect, named after its two authors. And it shows that talent increases the ability to be aware of one's limitations. Think about something, any skill or ability that you want to perfect or learn. Before you start, you might think that you're good at that, but when you start and start reading or practicing, and especially comparing yourself with people who are good, you become very aware of your limitations. And then that amount or degree of self-criticism stays with you even as you improve your abilities to the point of becoming an expert. So this effect shows that experts and people who are really bad at something differ a lot in their level of competence, but not so much in their level of self-perceived abilities. Mm-hmm. And paradoxically, and this is one of the major reasons for the prevalence of incompetent leaders, paradoxically, when you think you're better than you actually are at something, you will be better at fooling others because you have fooled yourself first.
Right.
So, the best way to lie is to lie to yourself first. If you're self-deceived or self-deluded, you will not show any insecurities or limitations, which unfortunately will help you come across as better than you actually are.
Okay, so we value this, we seem to value this confidence in men, but when women exhibit high confidence, we don't always like that, right?
That's true, and people often interpret this as unfair towards women, which it surely is, in the sense that we have double standards and the rules of the game are different for men than for women. But I'd like to point out that having these high standards that are in place when we evaluate female candidates for leadership is not so much the problem. The problem is that our standards are not sufficiently high when we evaluate men for leadership positions. So the solution to this problem is not to lower the bar when we're evaluating females so that more incompetent women become leaders.
Right.
The solution is to actually elevate our standards and realize that when men display overconfidence, that also shouldn't be interpreted as a sign of talent or competence. And we should also not tolerate displays of narcissism or excessive ambition in men, just like we do with women.
So, you know, what we understand is that getting feedback is a good thing for us. We should be open to feedback. That's how we get better. But that's also a tricky thing here, right? Because women don't get the same kind of feedback that men do. And men might even respond inappropriately to the feedback they get.
Correct. And so women are better at giving feedback when they are leaders, even though sometimes they can be so empathetic that they are conflict averse and they may find it difficult to provide negative feedback. On average, they are less self-centered and more other-oriented and better able to monitor their employees' performance. But when we look at women as receivers of feedback, we can see that they are at a disadvantage. Whether they have a male or a female boss, they tend to not get the same level of constructive critical feedback than men get. And also, when women seek feedback, that is often interpreted as a sign of weakness, whereas when men seek feedback, we see that as, a sign of them being curious, mm-hmm. humble, or having a great appetite for development and getting better.
It's interesting. You think about leadership books, and it's starting to appear now in the literature, but it certainly didn't before. This simple idea of how important just self-regulation is to being a decent leader, and I think it's true to be a decent human being, and that can turn out to be a problem much more for men than women.
Yeah, that is indeed the case. And I think that in general, you know, the literature on leadership has emphasized emergence more than effectiveness. We worry so much about what we should do in order to become leaders, because that tends to be almost the only way in which somebody can advance their career. But leadership should be interpreted as something that is a resource for the group, the organization, and other people. And of course, if the leader isn't capable of self-regulation and managing himself or herself, it's very unlikely that they will be able to manage their teams, groups, or units.
All right. And a great example of that, because I think it kind of shows the whole spectrum of this, is the basically profiling Steve Jobs, who is a legend, a legendary leader, but very problematic.
Yes, you know, and there is no disputing that Steve Jobs was a business genius and one of the most innovative people in recent times. Unfortunately, maybe because we are seduced by extraordinary achievers more when they also have flawed character traits, and Steve Jobs, you know, was also known for his dark side, for being incredibly excitable to the point of being bipolar, unpredictable, mm-hmm. narcissistic, and somewhat psychopathic as well. But I always say there's a reason why he was fired from his own companies twice, not once. Uh-huh. And if we are to emulate those behaviors, that's probably not going to make you very successful in your career. And fundamentally, most of the managers or leaders who are half as obnoxious as Steve Jobs was don't have the talents to back it up. You know,
right.
So it's a bit like saying, because John Coltrane or Bill Evans were heroin addicts, you need to take heroin in order to be a genius jazz musician, or because Einstein wasn't good at school, if you fail your school exams, you will probably win a Nobel Prize. No, it happens to be the case that some people are so talented that they can compensate for certain character flaws or deficiencies in other areas.
And often these figures are incredibly charismatic, and that's a big part of your book, talking about this sort of charisma myth. And you write in the book, you cannot measure charisma other than through others' perceptions of it. So that's an interesting thing, right? It's what other people are putting on the leader.
Exactly. And what we see in the studies on charisma is that we are more likely to attribute charisma to someone when they are powerful and in leadership roles. This is one of the reasons why women are not often seen as charismatic, because they need to emerge as senior leaders and be in the top first. We also know that the only reliable predictors of whether somebody is seen as charismatic are things like attractiveness, height, and it has not much to do with competence and intelligence. In essence, we attribute charisma to someone after seeing them for a few seconds or a couple of minutes. I always remind people that the best predictor of who wins an American presidential election after height, the height of the candidate, is the answer to the question, who would you rather have a beer with? And that is a very, very good measure of charisma, but obviously it has very little to do with the candidate's ability to be a good president. And, of course, most voters will never get to have a beer with that candidate, whether he or she wins or not.
Right.
So it shows that we emphasize these kind of immediate, instinctual, or intuitive reactions that we have to people without actually being able to judge their competence or talent for leadership.
Yeah, and I hadn't thought about the sort of measurement of charisma in that way, because we talk about this in our work in improvisation all the time, is when we talk about empathy, which is that you can't measure empathy from what's coming out of your mouth. It gets measured at the listener's ear. So that seems to be the other side of that coin.
Yes, generally speaking, in psychology, with any psychological construct, you are better off measuring it through other views and other perceptions than through self views. Perhaps the most consistent finding in the history of psychological research is that the person who we think we are is quite different from the person other people think we are. And although self views are important and consequential per se, we all get promoted, demoted, punished, rewarded in any area of life based on what other people think of us, not based on what we think of ourselves.
Yeah, and you use this term impression management as being absolutely key for getting ahead at work. And I imagine that a lot of successful male leaders are doing more work at impression management than tasks.
Correct. And this is an area where narcissists tend to excel. People with psychopathic tendencies who are good at manipulating others and more willing to take risks in interpersonal interactions also tend to have charming manipulative skills, but that is at the pathological and counterproductive level. In general, in most societies, impression management has a worse connotation than it should have. And I think that's partly because we like to perpetuate this myth that everybody should be authentic and be themselves and not worry about what other people think of them. Well, actually, you need to take other people into account. Mm-hmm. It helps to worry about them, including what they think of you. And the more time you spend trying to curate or manage your reputation, the better you will be in life. Where women are disadvantaged is that even when they do the same thing as men, they are maybe seen as more robotic, less natural, more manipulative. We tolerate the same behaviors more in men than in women.
You talk about also the importance of social capital, and social capital in itself is not a bad thing, right? I mean, that's a thing that we should all have, but that becomes very critical to being perceived as a good leader.
Absolutely, and in kind of immediate and superficial terms, on a superficial level, we can judge it at any point in time based on the network connections that you have forged or created for yourself in your job, in your organization, in your career. Even things like people's LinkedIn connections or social media connections are a good indicator of their social capital. Where it gets a little bit more uncomfortable for those of us who want a meritocratic society and who believe in upward social mobility is when you look at some of the predictors of these factors. It doesn't just have to do with your talent, with your motivation, with your dedication, your curiosity, or your open-mindedness. A lot of it comes from the socioeconomic status that you inherit. And of course, Although I spend most of my book talking about psychological traits, it would be naive to ignore the influence of social capital at birth in a person's likelihood of becoming a leader. It's not the same being born in Sierra Leone than in Switzerland or the United States. And even within the United States, some people have more opportunities and more potential for leadership based on the social capital than they inherit.
Yeah, I was talking to someone who works at a hospital recently, and they said the number one indicator of your potential for good care is your zip code.
Exactly. There's a reason why insurance companies take this into account. There's a reason why credit scoring agencies take this into account. And, for example, data for the U.S. indicates that in the 1970s, being born in this country, you had a 70 or 80% chance of improving your earnings compared to your parents. Hmm. And now the figure is closer to 50%, which means, it's 50-50 and it's going down. So I think the more meritocratic organizations and universities and schools can become, the more they will be able to disentangle the relationship between talent and social class.
I remember reading Daniel Goleman's book on emotional intelligence and finding it quite interesting and provocative. And I'm curious where that, you're a scientist. Where does the evidence stand on an idea like emotional intelligence right now?
Well, one of the interesting issues with the concept of emotional intelligence is that although Daniel Goleman just popularized this, and when you write a best-selling book, it's bound to be less academic and less technical than if you write a research or a scholarly book. Some of the claims he made and some of the ways in which he defined the term actually predated the evidence that came from scientific studies. But in many ways, most of the things he said were then verified or supported by academic evidence. And it's a really rare case where, nobody really decided to do research, much research in that area until there was a best-selling book. And then academics mostly went into it trying to discredit or refute the claims that Goleman made. But in all, they showed us what we've always known, which is that it matters to be rewarding to deal with, to have an ability to read and manage other people. And I think one of the most interesting recent findings around EQ or emotional intelligence is that to a great degree, it is about impression management, effective impression management. So if you have people with this impression management ability who are also ethical and have integrity, you get EQ. But if you get people with the same impression management or faking good ability, but they lack altruism and integrity, they are manipulative Machiavellian psychopaths.
That's interesting. So are women more often emotionally intelligent than men?
Yes. On most, there's about, 50 or 60 different measures available that are used in academic research on EQ and also in corporations to select leaders and vet leaders. And on pretty much all of them, in most of these scales, women have a slight advantage compared to men. This isn't surprising if you think that women are less overconfident, which makes them more self-aware. They also have higher levels of empathy and altruism, and they also tend to be friendlier and more pro-social. So these traits or characteristics are not new. We've had them before, from before emotional intelligence was introduced as a competency, but in many ways, emotional intelligence is a nice umbrella term for capturing all these qualities that actually do help people perform better as leaders.
Yeah, we had Dacre Keltner, the Berkeley scientist, on the pod, and he was citing some research where he was saying poor people, basically anyone in a lower status position, is more likely to see the truth of what's going on because they have to. So, and I think that's that overall in the book, that's a lot of what you're saying here is that it because women have been treated as second class citizens for decades, they've had to develop these qualities where they're better at seeing what's going on, more empathetic, more ethical, because it's a survival, a matter of survival.
Exactly. That's a really interesting point. And I think that you know, the issue here at heart is has to do with entitlement. On top of some natural dispositional differences between the genders, of course, if we enable one of the sexes to do whatever people want and there are no limits and, you know, they just are naturally more able to gain and attain status, it's going to exacerbate those same traits and make them more entitled, less other-centric, less altruistic, and so forth. But I think, you know, at the same time, culture has the ability to rewrite the rules of the game. Mm-hmm. And whenever you spend too much time selecting for some qualities, there's going to be a surplus of excess of that, you know, one of the most interesting paradigms in management sciences over the last decades is the too much of a good thing effect. Even if things like confidence, ambition, determination, maybe risk-taking had at some point made leaders better, if we select too much on these things, you're going to have overconfidence, reckless risk-taking, self-centeredness, self-absorption, and then there's going to be a premium for selecting people with a completely opposite profile.
Yeah, and I think that also strikes at the heart of the idea when the research around how having diverse teams is better, because you then come with a variety of different kinds of eyes and different applications and different kinds of problem solving. And it's not just like it's not all about social good. It's also about like getting the best work done.
Exactly. At the individual level, you can coach people so that they learn to go against their nature and develop the opposite pattern of behaviors and habits than what they naturally display. At the group level, especially if it's very hard for individuals to become the exact opposite of what they are, you try to create a synergy and get, you know, a higher degree of cognitive diversity, people who are psychologically different. Now, that's going to be a lot more challenging than having people who are all the same. This is one of the reasons why actually there is less clear evidence on the benefits or the ROI to having diverse teams than people think. It's a lot easier to manage people when they're all the same. They would even be able to manage themselves because they think alike. The minute you have people who are very different, you need better leadership. Otherwise, there's going to be friction and they're not going to be as tolerant, you know, with respect to each other.
All right. In a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, which is how we always end the podcast, a time in your life when you normally would have said no, but instead you said yes and what happened. But I have a couple more things I want to talk to you about. And this, there's a quote from the book that really struck at me. And the quote is this: even if the essence of leadership talent is universal, the context a leader is in will shape how they behave, ought to behave, and are evaluated. Tell us about the importance of context.
I think everything in life is contextual. So, and unfortunately, even within scientific psychology, there is this big divide with people like myself who focus on the individual and understanding what people are like, and then other people who focus on understanding the context. Both things interact and are perpetually intertwined and in a constant dialectic. I think with regards to leadership, of course, the context will shape the challenges and problems that leaders need to solve, the key stakeholders. Things like expertise and culture really are very context specific. But what I find fascinating is that at the same time, there are some universal features that make some people better leaders in any context. It's always better to have people who have more competence, more humility, more self-awareness, more people skills, and more integrity. Those things don't change, and they're the same whether we are evaluating Angela Merkel or Winston Churchill, Steve Jobs or Sheryl Sandberg.
Yeah, and the problem is also because the context changes. And this is the classic example you have of Churchill, who in one moment is an incredible leader. And in another moment, when the war is over, he's absolutely not.
Correct. And, you know, that said, he is always listed or given as an example for the situational aspects of leadership because it's an extreme case. Yeah. It's an extreme case. At the same time, if you read the biography of most accomplished and good leaders, you will see that there is a consistent pattern throughout times. They weren't once chosen for leaders and before it never occurred to them to be in a leadership role, or they never demonstrated leadership in any other context. Even Winston Churchill, of course, he was already in the leadership because he was a politician, fairly accomplished, with certain character traits that made him a good candidate for that time. Then, of course, he was too inflexible and rigid in his style to adjust to peaceful times. So I think the main message there is that if you are too rigid and you just have one way of leading, your prospects will be constrained.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think of Elon Musk as a leader.
Well, you know, I think there's no questioning his creativity, his innovation. In many ways, he is similar to Steve Jobs in that we can also see derailing traits and a clear dark side. I think, let's see. Even if he could accomplish 10% of what he wants to accomplish, he would make an extraordinary contribution to modern society. But I would still argue that he would be a better leader if he didn't have these dark side traits, or if he could keep them in check. I think to a large degree, his future success depends on his ability to self-coach and control his impulsive and authoritarian outbursts.
Yep, self-regulation. Okay, so we're going to ask you for a yes and story. In the parlance of improvisation, when you're creating something out of nothing, you can't do that by saying no, and you actually can't really accomplish much by just saying yes. You have to say yes and, you have to affirm and contribute in order to explore and heighten. And I'm wondering if you have a yes and moment that you could share with us.
Yes is the answer, and I think my yes and moment was mostly my decision to not abandon psychology, but reframe slightly what I focused on. I started my career as a clinical psychologist. I had patients in Argentina where I grew up, and I was mostly dealing with paranoid schizophrenics and people with severe psychopathologies. And although I found that it was quite depressing and difficult to help them, which almost led me to abandon my career in psychology completely, I decided instead to reframe slightly and focus on the world of business. And I would say it helps to have treated paranoid, schizophrenic patients if you want to understand the world of business, where people are obviously much more better functioning and not, they don't suffer from these incredibly debilitating diseases. But I think anything creative happens as a result of combining things that are slightly unrelated. And for me, that was it. It was, you know, having had an in-depth understanding of psychological disorders, it helped me coach and understand leaders in the business world and in organizations. And by the way, that also kind of triggered me to focus more on the negative aspects of leadership than the positive aspects of leadership.
The book is called Why Do So Many Incompetent Men Become Leaders? Thomas, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm up before the sun. When my work day is over, I'm tired from having fun. I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine.